From the KLYT broadcast studio, this is ABQ Connect. Your input on today's topic is important to us. Join in the conversation by calling 505-338-5790 or text 505-585-LIVE. ABQ Connect.
Well, thanks for joining us on ABQ Connect. I'm Steve Ryman, and in studio with us, Paul Gessing, the Rio Grande Foundation. Paul, thanks for coming in again.
Hey, Steve, good to be with you again.
I'll tell you the same thing I told Carla Sontag last week. I hope our listeners appreciate so much the time that you and Carla and others put into fact-finding and information providing. I feel lazy.
Well, we try to do the best we can to bring important information to light about what's happening in the state of New Mexico and ways that we, especially folks going to vote at the polls, can make a difference in the future of the state of New Mexico.
You know, speaking of which, going to the polls, and, you know, I was off the air recently telling someone, you know, often listeners hear, but they don't necessarily listen. and I love the listener, absolutely. They know that if we've had any dialogue, or whether it's face to face or via email. However, I'm going to call myself out. I wasn't really listening this week when I heard early voting had started, and I drove to the place that I knew there was a early voting location. And saw the sign on the window that said that they would open on October 22nd. And I wasn't really interested, Paul, in driving down to the county clerk's office. So,
yeah, election day is a little on the late side this year because of the way the calendar works out. So that's November 8th. And that means that, you know, sometimes you get early voting starting right up in the middle of the month. Not this month so much. It won't start until the 22nd on the traditional, you know, early voting locations that are very convenient. The ones that I choose to vote at more often than not, you can definitely go down to the clerk's office, and wherever you are in the state, your county clerk should be hosting early voting right now. So if you, for some reason, maybe don't like absentee ballots, but you're spending some time out of the country, you're out of state, it's a great opportunity to get down there and vote. But, yeah, not everybody wants to go downtown. I happen to work downtown, and I still like to wait for the traditional early voting because you never know. People who voted already got, you know, didn't get to see the debate last night, for example.
Right. Do you ever absentee?
I haven't
either.
Not since I moved to New Mexico 16 and a half years ago. With early voting, it's so easy.
Yeah.
And there's debates and discussion about early voting, how much is enough, et cetera, et cetera. I'm kind of the view that I'm fine with the early voting that we have a couple weeks. I think it's too early maybe at the clerk's office unless you have a specific reason because things can change. And I generally avoid absentee balloting because there's always problems with the mail. We've all had them over the years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just like the security of voting in person.
Now, that being said, people should know that if you do have an absentee ballot that you fill out, and especially if you're concerned about when you get it, you know, what you said, Paul, you know, I hope it gets where it's going to supposed to get. And if you wait until later and you wonder if it's going to get to where it's supposed to be in time, you can take those absentee ballots filled out. Make sure you follow all the directions that are given on the ballot. But you can drop them off at one of the early voting locations. On election day, you can go to a polling site of, you know, you can drop them off on election day as well. So just a heads up, we want to make sure everyone's vote gets in at least once, Paul.
Vote early, yes. Vote often, not so much.
Right. Well, we've got a lot to talk about today, and we covered some of it already, talking about early voting. And you have information about that on the website at errorsofenchantment.com. Is there anything on that that we haven't covered?
No, no, that's it's pretty simple right now. County clerk's office, the annex. I don't have the exact address offhand, but it is in downtown Albuquerque. I recommend waiting till Saturday the 22nd when your usual voting convenience centers get going. And then some people do the very traditional types like to vote on election day itself. I like tradition, and I like not having a line, and not having a line outweighs my desire to traditionally vote on that particular day.
Have you heard any hypothesis or conjecture about what lines might be like for the midterm?
There always seems to be something at the election day polls. It's just there are a sufficient number of people who like to vote last minute, and that tends to be something you get 5, 6, 7 in the evening, afternoon, because the polls tend to close at 7. So I hope that voting turnout is very good this year. I think there are a lot of issues, and we're going to talk about them as well, down the ballot that maybe not aren't as high profile as some of the things that have been discussed, you know, the governor's race, congressional races, et cetera. There's a lot of issues down ballot that are very important. And I hope that we have a large swath of New Mexico's population weighing in and sharing their views and voting on those issues.
I would amen that. Paul, is there still an opportunity to register if you haven't registered?
I believe so, because we have essentially day of voter registration.
Okay.
I'm not privy to the exact details, but I would recommend whatever county you're in, check with the clerk's office and see what that process is at this point.
Yeah, please do get registered. And then, you know, that's really important. That it's important that you go vote after you register. So we hope you'll do that. Now, I barely made it home last night. Got set up right in front of the TV just as the debate was getting ready to start. So I missed the last one, Paul, but I was able to see all of this one. Was anything covered last night that wasn't covered already in the other debates?
Yes. In fact, a favorite topic that we have discussed, by we, I mean the royal we, your predecessor and yourself, the Energy Transition Act, something that the Rio Grande Foundation has focused a lot of our attention on. Of course, we saw the closure of one of New Mexico's coal-fired power plants at the end of the month of September. That was a delayed situation from originally being the end of June. The governor, in an election year, did not want to see brownouts and blackouts, because PNM has expressed repeatedly a great deal of concern about the blackouts and brownouts that we've seen in states like California, even states like Texas, which, while conservative, has gone down the green path in terms of its energy production. Governor didn't want to see that, so we got 3 more months of the coal-fired power plants remaining open, but now it has been shuttered. And like I said, PNM's very concerned about the future. That was brought up in last night's debate. That was not brought up in the KOB4 debate on October 1st.
You know, I told you off the air, I'm really looking forward to hearing your comments about the debate, just to train myself maybe to better watch debates and what to take from them. And I'll tell you, from a layperson's point of view, part of what I took, this is what I came away from, and I'd be interested to know how strategic this was for both camps. The two things that I kept hearing come up was your mentor, I forget if it was a whirlwind or a hurricane of a lettuce or a salad of words or whatever it was that continued to be said, but it was used more than once, and it was just kind of interesting to see the candidates. I remember we talked about this once before. At a younger age, when I wasn't as involved in politics, it just seemed often so much more civil.
I'm not going to talk about civility. I do think that having more honest discussion of the issues.
That I appreciate.
Has been maybe done better in the past. I think in particular, Lujan Grisham tried to obfuscate and make light of some of her shortcomings, especially the, for lack of a better word, Crotchgate, where she allegedly grabbed a staffer and made some remarks about that and then wound up paying a settlement. And for her to try to turn that back on Ron Ketty just is hard to believe. She, you know, should show leadership and ownership of that and say, yeah, I made a mistake. It was something I'm not proud of. I'm not going to do it again. But, you know, we've seen out of this administration, COVID, you know, never apologizing to the businesses that shut down, never acknowledging that her policies failed, which they did, both in the lockdown itself, but also with the kids, the education that was lost, and the businesses that were shuttered. You know, and that's kind of a modern par for the course kind of thing. I'm not going to say it's equal among the parties, but it seems that it's much more common in both parties nowadays than it used to be, whereas you just don't say you screwed up and made a mistake or that you did something that didn't quite work out.
Yeah, you know, it does seem to me the times that I've followed any story like that, when someone does own up to what they did, apologizes for it, it's just so much easier to move on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree completely. Now, so before we dive into the debate itself, you know, the top line thing was, and this was from both debates, we know Michelle Lujan Grisham is diminutive. She is a short woman, somewhere in the 4 foot plus side of things. So she's below 5 foot. And in both debates, and I watched them both carefully, you noticed that Michelle Lujan Grisham was not standing next to. You often in a presidential debate would get the wide angle shot of the two candidates or sometimes three candidates or more, all standing next to each other. Both of these debates only involved close shots of the two of them. And if you really look carefully, you would know that Michelle Lujan Grisham was sitting while Ron Ketty was standing. Now, in a debate, I choose standing every time because that gives your airflow better opportunity to, you know, navigate through your body and your windpipes and all those kinds of things. But it also gives you just a feel of more authoritative, more you know, in power situation than sitting and talking. And that had many impacts, I think, on both debates. And the first one on KOB, the governor sat with a microphone sitting next to her that like towered over her head. And that looked very odd in this debate. And I don't know that this had anything to do with her sitting, but she had her arms, you know, wrapped. This is the only thing I can say is that this is like a teacher or my mom. If I did something wrong, she would frequently, you know, wrap the arms in front of her in a pretzel formation and kind of tap her toes or something. It very much gave a negative vibe to everything Lujan Grisham had to say, and that's just from body language alone.
Now, I did notice when she spoke that changed.
She did. She used her hands a lot more.
Yeah. And I did notice that. I actually looked it up because I know from interviews and what have you, that's just one of the things you're encouraged not to do. And I've heard different things. I actually looked it up last night, and the only thing I'm recalling from what I looked up last night, sometimes it is a sign possibly of fear or anxiety. I don't want to say any, those are the, for sure, two of the things that I saw. I didn't necessarily get that from what she was saying. Anyway, it was noticeable. I'm no consultant on things like that, but I do wonder how much of an impact, it might have.
Yeah, and the classic political science case you often hear about somebody doing or people having a different viewpoint on something based on body language is goes way back. It goes to Kennedy-Nixon debate way back in the day when television was just a new thing. And people on the radio listening thought that Nixon won because of his apparently better answers. I wasn't even a glimmer in my family's eye at that point. But but people who watched on this newfangled television device that they had in their living rooms thought that Kennedy did better. Obviously, Kennedy being a good-looking guy, full head of hair. I'm not jealous or anything, but Nixon was also, you know, they're under these very hot TV lights, and I'm sure back in those days they were hotter than they are now because of technology changes. Nixon was kind of getting sweaty and mopping his brow and just not as photogenic of a guy as Kennedy, and so people had very different impressions of those debates and the way they turned out debating, depending on how they consumed them. And I just hope that enough New Mexicans stayed tuned and checked those debates out and did so with a, you know, just a educated or somewhat skeptical approach regarding what these two candidates had in mind, because I think the winner was clear.
Yeah, and although what we've talked about, body language, it's obviously important. But there's so much more to talk about when it comes to the debate. Where do we go from here?
Absolutely. Well, we can talk about the ballot and what folks are going to be confronted with when they go to the polls, whether it's heading down to the county clerk's office this afternoon, or whether they're waiting until election day, or if they're going to just go do the early voting when that gets rolling here on the 22nd. So, we've got a lot of issues that people are facing on this ballot. Obviously, you know, governor, Congress, those are some of the top line races. You've got a sheriff's race here in Bernalillo County, partisan race. One of the things that I really like to talk about, though, is we all talk about crime. We all hear about crime. The first issue out of the blocks in the first debate and the first issue last night was crime as well. And it's a critical issue. And you hear about it from the governor candidates. You hear about it from others, but you've got to focus on sheriff. You've got to focus on your judges as well. And a lot of times people don't know what those judges are doing or saying, because we have very convoluted rules for judicial elections in this state. So you have two of New Mexico's five Supreme Court candidates up. Those are partisan races where a Republican is running against a Democrat. Now, if you think the judiciary is going great, we have four Michelle Lujan Grisham nominees that are currently on the bench, and you have one additional who was put there to replace a retiring judge who's in a retention election. So I'll get to that in a second, but you have two partisan Supreme Court races. Then you have some Court of Appeals races as well. Those are also partisan. You have a whole slew of races that there's no one challenging the other judge. Those are lower, you know, municipal court and whatnot. And that just has to do with the way the process works and who gets to nominate those judges. So those are just nothing. There's you can vote for the person, you can't vote for the person. It doesn't matter because they're running unopposed. And as long as they vote for themselves or their mom votes for them, they're going to get elected
again. One vote.
Yeah, one vote is all that matters. But then you have the retention election for Justice Michael Vigil, and that has to do with somebody, like I said, who replaced another judge on the bench and has not been through a competitive election. So they go through the retention election. You have to get 57% of the vote, but it's kind of like, you know, somebody maybe who is, you know, challenging a mountain or something. You know, they're climbing a mountain. That's all. It's myself versus the mountain. It's Justice Vigil versus the 57%. So it is a higher threshold, and people can vote on whether they think they want to retain him or not. And again, judges have a lot of roles to play regarding crime. And I just question, if you're voting for those judges, are you happy with the way things are? I would encourage people to at least look at what those candidates stand for and say, you know, are these the values that I represent or I want to vote for again? And then you have a charter amendment in the county. It's a very trivial charter amendment, but it's not listed in detail on the ballot. It has to do with who gets to hire the fire chief primarily in the county. Can the county manager do that directly, or can the county, does the county commission have to be involved? I don't think that's a very big deal. So, but it is, you know, anytime you're looking at, whoa, they're changing the governing documents of Bernalillo County, that, you know, is a red flag or something that sticks up in importance. So, just want to make sure folks are aware of that. I always vote against all bonds because voters around here have a bad tendency of approving all the bonds. Bonds are debt that the government takes out that is ultimately paid for by your and my tax dollars, typically property taxes. So, you know, I figure if one fails once every, you know, blue moon in terms of elections, then, you know, the people in charge have to be a little more fiscally transparent, a little prudent, make some tougher decisions. But again, I just vote against them because so often it seems like other voters and a majority of voters just always say yes for every single bond.
And somehow the roads still get repaired.
Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah, if you voted against bonds all the time and started to see them, you know, killed every single time, that might be a different situation. But we very rarely see that. And, you know, we know property taxes have crept up. We know that that is a bigger and bigger burden for people, especially on a fixed income, especially when we saw the kind of run-up we have in property values in recent years. It takes more, you know, you're going to pay higher taxes on that.
Right. And for those who might think, well, I don't own a property. Well, if you're renting somewhere, someone owns the property.
Yeah.
And their taxes are going up, and they're probably not going to just, you know, pony up that extra. They're probably going to pass that along.
Exactly. And finally, there's constitutional amendments. Amendment one is tapping into one of the permanent funds for pre-K and early childhood spending. And that is a permanent fund that they can just take that money out of by changing the Constitution. It's a process. And we've seen studies and reported on studies that show that pre-K is not particularly effective. It's not an ideal environment for those young kids to be a part of. We would rather see some of the big surplus that we have available to the legislature, if they want to do pre-K, to go and use it for that. But I understand the permanent fund is an easy target, and that is Amendment 1, which polling shows is probably going to pass. But we don't know as much about Amendment 2, and that would allow the legislature to fund infrastructure projects for private benefit. That's kind of another loophole that we're looking at creating for the anti-donation clause, which is back to the original days of the Constitution, designed to stop government from publicly contributing funds to private businesses. In those days, it was the railroads. You had a lot of scandals back in the 1900s and 1800s of governments getting into bed with the railroads and providing very large subsidies and then losing out on that money if a railroad mismanaged itself or went bust. This case, it's people want to see broadband, water, other infrastructure provided for private benefits, ostensibly for low-income people. But, you know, you've really got to question the idea of amending the state constitution to allow that kind of thing to happen. I'll just say that once upon a time, and over a decade ago, a prominent legislator got the state to finance the paving of a road on private property leading to the house of a prominent lobbyist. That was a scandal. It was illegal, but I really don't think that should be legalized in the state of New Mexico.
All right. Well, listen, I just looked down and saw what time it was. Then I looked at my engineer like, what did I do? We blew right past the break, which, by the way, I want to thank Abby for taking over the reins. Jared, our newer engineer, out for the day. So Abby's got the reins today. Appreciate what she's doing to keep us going. And she's going to continue to do that. And we'll hear more from Paul Gessing of the Rio Grande Foundation after the break on ABQ Connect.
Grandpa, what does it mean that we have freedom?
Grandpa, is that what your war was about?
Grandpa, what's the Constitution?
Grandpa, who decides who runs the country?
Grandpa, how come you look so grumpy when that man talks on TV?
Grandpa, tell me what America is going to be like when I'm your age.
Grandpa, did you vote?
Plan for America's future. Register, be informed, and vote. a word of encouragement from Focus on the Family.
Eastern Hills Christian Academy is a Christ-centered private school serving children from preschool through eighth grade. Since 1973, they've been dedicated to providing students a quality education. Eastern Hills Christian Academy is committed to partnering with parents to raise the next generation to be rooted in Scripture and growing in Christ.
My children have been attending Eastern Hills since preschool. The entire staff has created a phenomenal educational program, a safe environment, and a culture where every child is cherished for who they are. The small class sizes allow teachers to give individualized attention to every child, allows them to grow and excel at their strengths, and engages parents, which creates an inclusive environment. It's the best faith-based small school learning environment in Albuquerque.
Still looking? EHCA is still accepting students. EasternHillsChristianAcademy.org. EasternHillsChristianAcademy.org.
Many parents get a social security number for their newborn infants before leaving the hospital, creating more potential victims of identity theft. Hi, I'm Rob West with your MoneyWise Minute. About 1.25 million children have their identity stolen each year. Sadly, most of them know the perpetrators. They're often family or friends. Here's how to protect your kids. If they have accounts in their name, like a 529 education savings plan or a custodial banking account or one for Social Security at SSA.gov, use a strong and unique password for each account. You can also freeze their credit at the three credit bureaus. It's not uncommon for kids to have credit reports these days. Take those steps and it'll make it much harder for thieves to steal your child's identity. The MoneyWise Minute is sponsored by John Moore Associates, an investment advisor registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. More information about biblical investing is at johnmoore.com.
You're listening to KLYT. Welcome back to ABQ Connect. Today's show is sponsored in part by Ben Lucero at Indigo Mortgage, 505-836-5700, or online at indigomortgage.net. Thank you, Indigo Mortgage, for your support of KLYT and ABQ Connect.
I always like to say thank you so much, Ben Lucero, myself. I'm acquainted with Ben and appreciate what he does to support Christian Radio, along with the rest of the team at Indigo Mortgage. So much appreciate, support of Christian Radio. And in studio with us, Paul Gessing is here from the Rio Grande Foundation. And Paul, before we move on, let's remind people what they can find at the website, Rio Grande Foundation or Heirs of Enchantment, including support, because you're a nonprofit organization.
We are. We're a nonprofit. We're supported by New Mexicans who share our values and goals of bringing more freedom and individual liberty to the state of New Mexico. You can go to errorsofenchantment.com and find out what we are talking about. A lot of the information, background data, links are posted at that site. It's considered our blog. Then riograndefoundation.org has other information, a little more dense, in-depth information, but also vote tracking in the legislature. You can find out how your legislators vote on the issues and all kinds of other stuff. In both places, you can sign up for our email list. You can also sign up for our, to support the foundation if you're so inclined.
Paul, is there any opportunities for volunteers? Do you need volunteers for anything?
On occasion, we have some events that people come through that we have them speak about various things. But being in a think tank kind of more academic and research setting, it's tough to have volunteers for that unless you have a background in some kind of field of interest in economic policy or something. But you can don't hesitate to reach out to us. info@riograndefoundation.org, info@riograndefoundation.org.
And those actually just tuning in and joining the conversation, you've missed, we talked a little bit about voting, early voting, dates, registering to vote. And we also talked about the shutdown of the coal-fired power plant in New Mexico. Let's see, the gubernatorial debate, which many of the folks listening hopefully were dialed into last night. I didn't go into that. I don't want to bring up the whole debate again, but Paul, I didn't go into it really feeling like it's probably going to do anything to change my vote. I think my intent more in watching it was in the event that I got into a conversation with someone on one of these issues that I better understood where the gubernatorial candidates stand.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the benefits of the debates. I mean, yeah, Michelle Lujan Grisham has a track record of the last 4 years. She's pretty sparse in her proclamations about what she's going to do in the next 4 years. And certainly in the first debate, Ron Ketty called her out about that. And that's really, I think, one of the benefits is that we have a media, present company excluded, of course, that often does not question. And I think it's gotten worse, especially under COVID and since COVID. A lot of the policies put forth predominantly here in New Mexico by Democrat policymakers, they tend to be very favorable towards those folks. So, during COVID, there was never any question about, well, will these lockdowns work? Will keeping kids home from school have more negative questions than any positive impacts that we might see in terms of spreading or lack of spread of the virus? A lot of media really became captured by the governor and her approach to things for a variety of reasons. These debates are, if nothing else, an opportunity for Ron Ketty, her challenger, to ask her questions that unfortunately have not been discussed at great length. I mean, the media has reported on the Energy Transition Act, but they haven't talked about how the Energy Transition Act is directly related and the governor's policies with regard to energy are directly related to potential blackouts and brownouts and you not having enough electricity next summer when the summer heating season or cooling season really kicks up.
And one of the other things I did notice last night was she again clearly showed her support for the Inflation Reduction Act. The other thing that actually before Mr. Ron Ketty said anything, she was often saying things about what he will do when he, if elected governor. And I was, as I heard that, I was actually, well, that's curious. I wonder if that's something that, how does she know that? does she have a secret pipeline to something that we're not aware of? But then when Mark, addressed it, it made more sense. It was, just appeared to be just strategy. But regardless,
well, of course, the issue of abortion has been a top level that has been discussed and debated. And, quite honestly, I talked to Ron Ketty before his first debate. And, I'm of the belief that while in New Mexico, an outright ban on abortion may not be politically viable. And the whole Smotherman situation is a bit of a liability for Ron Ketty, and that's where Michelle Lujan Grisham's trying to connect the dots there. Talking about how she wants to fund, using our tax dollars, an abortion clinic on the border with Texas, and doing so without the support of the legislature even, which might be predisposed to that kind of thing, but is doing that on her own volition, allocating $10 million of capital outlay, that she has her own kind of radical positions at the cutting edge of where policymakers, where the public, she's really taking on a very strong pro-choice position, not just being pro-choice, but saying you, the taxpayers, are going to pay the bill for Texans coming over the border for abortions. That's something that I think a lot of people in the middle, which a lot of people are in the middle on abortion, that's going to not fly very far with a lot of them.
Well, and the last time you were on, we talked about the $10 million clinic that she built in Las Cruces.
She hasn't built it yet. It's on the agenda for
her. Thank you, Paul, for correcting me. But it reminds us of all these unilateral decisions that were being made during the pandemic.
Right.
Who decided that... The well, I get, you know what? The voters decided to a certain extent. I'll say that, Paul, about that, because if she has the power to unilaterally make a decision like that, well, the voters elected the person who did it. So it's really, you know, to a certain extent, it's, you know, this is why it's so important to get to the polls.
Well, it is true that the voters elected Michelle Lujan Grisham, you know, now on about 4 years ago, and that's reality. But nobody, including myself, knew what we were coming into in terms of COVID-19 and how that was going to have profound impacts on our lives and the way governance worked. And, you know, people in the legislature in New Mexico, on a pretty bipartisan basis, did empower the governor right after 9/11, actually, to really take the reins of New Mexico government. And I think certainly Republicans, but I think a fair number of Democrats maybe had the chance to reconsider their actions in light of what happened during COVID, might have gone back and been a little more insistent that the legislature have a seat at the table, that there be some kind of time limitations on this. And that factor came through in both of the debates, because the Ron Ketty campaign has been running against the governor on her releasing 700 inmates due to COVID-19 protocols that she came up with in March and April of 2020. Well, you know, releasing people out of prisons at a time when there's a global pandemic, where you don't have a lot of information about how this is going to affect people and they're in closed prison cells, that kind of stuff, I can kind of understand that. But remember, she's acting alone, and there's no oversight from the legislature regarding any of her COVID policies. So now here we are, 2.5 years into COVID, and that policy had remained in place. She finally rescinded it a few weeks ago because Ron Ketty's campaign was making hay on that issue. And then in the debate last night, and I believe in the Channel 4 debate a couple weeks ago, that was brought up as well. So I just think from a governance perspective that it should be something that we have more eyeballs on, more policy discussion of. Yeah, if we have, say, a war or an attack comes and directly impacts New Mexico, we all want to have one person we can rely on, you know, for 30 or so days unquestioned. And then if we have the legislature sit down and say, okay, now we have to reapprove this policy, that's okay, or at least have that discussion, but not just I get to renew it every 30 days. And I don't know what it is about that COVID policy, but I know that Ron Ketty has polling data that has kind of turned him away from wanting to directly challenge the governor on that. But we at the Rio Grande Foundation don't need to worry about polling. That's one of the things that we get to benefit from. And I find it unconscionable and anti-democratic that we have that kind of policy in place here 2.5 years in.
All right. Well, great information. I think back to about a few minutes ago when I said, not to rehash the debate, but I'm actually glad we did get back into some of those topics. Let's move on. You know, last month, Paul, when you were, I think it was last month or the month before, we talked about California and the legislation that would prohibit gas vehicles after 2035. And then the week after that was announced, the brownout in California, questioning, well, what are you going to do if you have no gas vehicles? Then all of a sudden you're dealing with brownouts. And knowing that there's a potential for that to eventually happen here, the same policy on the same issue, there's another one happening in California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, real quickly, it is important to know, and again, this is anti-democratic. We're talking about small d democracy,
right?
You know, not Democratic Party or Republican D and R. We're talking about small d. And that just has to do with, do the people have a say on these public policy issues, or is it a board appointed by a governor who was elected by a certain number of people? And, you know, it's the same situation here in New Mexico as it is in California. In California, it's the California Air Resources Board that's banning the sale of internal combustion engines. It's the California Air Resources Board that recently decided to ban hot water heaters and furnaces that have natural gas, that use natural gas in new construction in homes in the state of California. Now, there have been cities, including Los Angeles, that have not only banned hot water heaters and furnaces in new construction, but they're also banning gas stoves in restaurants. And that's a huge issue. Now, that's not what the California Air Resources Board did statewide, but still, heaters and furnaces, very big deal. And it's something that we know California's got trouble keeping the lights on. They've followed the same policies. We followed their policies in New Mexico. We, too, have an unelected board that passed restrictions on the sale of internal combustion engines. Not an outright ban yet, but, of course, the governor may have a opportunity to do that after the election. And I think it's also worth questioning if she is going to act in the same way on furnaces and hot water heaters that are using natural gas. We know for sure that Senator Martin Heinrich talks about this and makes it a very big deal on social media and in his time in the U.S. Senate. This is not pie in the sky, completely out of touch with reality in terms of the wondering what is going to happen with natural gas appliances in the home in the not too distant future. I could very easily see this governor acting by herself through the Environmental Improvement Board, our own unelected board, appointed by her to do some of these policies. And that's, unfortunately, left on the cutting room floor stuff that doesn't get brought up in an hour-long debate, that, gosh, I would love to see that kind of thing happen. Now, the governor could say whatever she's going to say, but at least when she does something in the future, then you have, hey, you said you weren't going to do this or whatever that we can look back on. But, yeah, here, that's an incredibly important policy that's really not being discussed in this race.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you look at it, well, wait a minute, no gas, no natural gas. And like you mentioned, well, the only thing I can think of they'd power those with then is electricity, and they're already having a difficult time. So, you know, is every home going to have its own little nuclear provider of energy? I mean, what, you know, if you just stop using the things we're using to provide energy, you know, wind and electricity hasn't been something that is sustainable, that seems to provide enough. What could they possibly be thinking? I don't get that.
Well, so boy, one of the interesting things that you may have seen is that PNM recently asked the PRC, so utility asked the PRC for a rate increase on our electric bills for the smart grid technology. Now, this is getting a little bit into the weeds, but I'll do my best to keep it simple, which is the smart grid is, among other things, going to hopefully attempt to allocate electrical resources using market forces, hopefully market forces, not force, to try to get people to use electricity available in ways that are more efficient. Because, for example, if you just have a coal-fired power plant, now we obviously are getting rid of those, but we do have a certain amount of coal and other baseload electricity on the grid. You use a lot of it during the summer, in the middle of the day when the air conditioning is going, and then a lot less of it in the evening. Now we have, generally speaking, lower demand for electricity unless it gets really super cold. So the idea is to, with this constant source of electricity available, allocate the resource as it's available on the grid and price it accordingly. So you have people that would, if they have an electric vehicle, charge that vehicle from midnight to 5 a.m. when electricity demand is way down. That's the theory. But who's paying for it? We're paying for it in this process that PNM is setting them in. It's one of the ways they are hoping to use technology to overcome a fundamental shortage of electricity on the grid. They are still going to have to deal with, by next summer, getting the grid and getting the power out to people that they just don't have, and we don't know where it's going to come from. Certainly, I've talked about this in a number of outlets. Buying a generator is not a bad investment for New Mexicans, given what could happen as soon as next summer.
All right. We're up against the break. We're going to do that. When we come back, talk a little bit about people packing up and moving from some states, moving to others, and higher taxes. That's all coming up after the break, as we continue our discussion with Paul Gessing of the Rio Grande Foundation on ABQ Connect.
Calvary Chapel New Harvest is located in the heart of Valencia County and serves the community of Los Lunas and the surrounding area. They gather Sunday morning for worship services at 8 and 10, and the Wednesday night service at 7, led by Pastor David Maestas. Located on Main Street, they also provide programs for kids and youth. Find more details at calvarynhll.org.
John Chitwood of Southern Boulevard Automotive.
I have towed many vehicles in for repair, with the customer stating the car just stalled while I was driving. After diagnosing it, I've had to make that phone call many times and state to the customer, you're out of gas and you need to refuel. Many Christians are like that. They need to be refueling daily with God's Word in order to keep themselves moving forward and to have the mind of Christ. Dwight L. Moody was once asked why he urged Christians to be filled constantly with the Holy Spirit. He replied, I need continuous and filling because I leak. What gauge do you use in your life to know if you're running on empty of the infilling of God's Spirit?
Southern Boulevard Automotive, 2300 Southern Boulevard in Rio Rancho, 892-2300 or southernblvdautomotive.com. Thank you, John Chitwood at Southern Boulevard Automotive, for your support of KLYT 88.3 FM.
It's that time of year. Kids notice the costume and candy section at the store, and you wonder what you're going to do on October 31st. Well, Calvary Church has you covered. Enjoy Fall Fest this year, Monday night, October 31st, 5:30 at Calvary Church at Osuna and the Westside Calvary Campus. It's a free event and a great opportunity to invite your neighbors for a fun night of candy, games, bounce houses, food trucks, and more. Wear your family-friendly costume. Details at CalvaryNM.Church.
On KLYT, this is ABQ Connect. There's still time to join the conversation by calling 505-338-5790 or text 505-585-LIVE. ABQ Connect.
I'm Steve Ryman, and I, along with the rest of the staff at KLYT, are so glad you took the time to tune in this afternoon for ABQ Connect. We hope you'll continue to do so on the 1 o'clock hour. Of course, we routinely remind you, you hear it coming into the show and other times, that we would welcome your phone calls at 505-338-5790 or text 585-LIVE. That's 505-585-LIVE. In studio with the president of Rio Grande Foundation, Paul Gessing, is here. We've covered a variety of topics up to this point, and look soon for the archived broadcast. If you missed any of today's broadcast, you'll be able to listen to or download it from abqconnect.online. And Paul, as we move forward, taxes.
Yeah.
They're all going down. They're going away.
I wish. And they should. And, you know, to her credit, Lujan Grisham did cut taxes during her time in office. She started out by increasing them in 2019. So let me be clear that she took a surplus that she had in 2019 when she took office and immediately raised taxes. Then the money became so fantastical out of the oil and gas industry that she was able to reduce some taxes, including the gross receipts tax, including Social Security taxes, military pensions, some what are honestly not huge tax cuts, given the amount of money flowing out of the oil and gas industry. I mean, before that session last year, Senator George Munoz from the Finance Committee said, we have more money than we know what to do with. So heading into an election where she knew she was going to face a challenge, the governor decided to return some of those dollars to us. But we have fundamental economic issues that need to be addressed here in the state of New Mexico. And one of those dovetails quite nicely with the discussion about raising taxes on alcohol in New Mexico. Now, this is a challenging problem because a report came out that was circulated pretty widely around New Mexico that we have serious alcohol death-related issues in the state of New Mexico. And, you know, it outlines, you know, some ways that maybe we should address those. And a legislative committee that was meeting in the interim recently said, hey, we think we should raise taxes on alcohol for everybody, that's the way to address this problem of New Mexico's serious problems with alcohol use and abuse. Now, we do have massive budget surplus. I think we have plenty of money to study what best ways there are out there to address these alcohol-related issues, to make sure that we have treatment options available for people that need them, and to do all that without raising taxes. New Mexico is in the middle of the pack. We are like 25th nationwide when it comes to overall taxes on alcohol. But one thing that's interesting is that several years ago, over a decade now, former Senator Sue Wilson Beffert, a Republican from kind of the East Mountains area, she put forth a bill that passed that reduced the rate of taxation on microbrews. And we've seen this burgeoning industry. You can't throw a rock around town. It's one of the things that really has taken off is you got your Marble, your Bosque, your Ex Novo, your breweries all up and down, and I'm just getting started. You could name right. another 10 or 15
do you,
more.
Do you happen to know, is that a state thing or is that nationwide?
There are a lot of microbrews around, more so nationwide, but one of the things that New Mexico had not seen, at least originally, as much of was the development of those breweries. And then they came along and the legislature said, we're going to cut taxes on the alcohol on those microbrews. And
so
that
people
became,
they had a reason to come here.
Yeah.
Well, Ex Novo, my understanding, I think they were out of Portland. I don't know how many other ones they have. But that's, I believe, where they started. So that, and I don't know if that's why they did come, but that it makes sense.
Portland was and is an epicenter of the craft brewing industry. And the point I want to make is, though, that, you know, with the lower taxes on those specific breweries, these are still high end, you know, I love all those breweries, but they're kind of beer snobby places. These are places where people of means, who are interested in the taste of their beer, not, you know, how many drinks can I shove down my throat and then get out on the road, or can I drink by myself? These are places where you have high quality beers that are being produced for people who want to taste those beers and enjoy that atmosphere.
And let me say this to the KLYT listener. We know a large percentage of our listeners don't partake.
And that's fine.
And we're not, that's not the discussion we're having.
Right.
So before you get lost in that, listener.
Right.
Listen to where Paul's going with this.
Right. Just, so those people by and large are not the problem. Or if they are, we should at least study and understand that before we go raising taxes on that industry. And that's my point, is that we don't have a shortage of revenue. Yes, you can raise taxes on any industry. And if you raise those taxes high enough, you will, by some way, kill that industry or dramatically hinder it. We've, of course, in this country gone down that path once before at the federal level with prohibition. I don't think we want to see that kind of level of taxation. My point is, we want to see the issues, the problems addressed with whether it's DWI or just people drinking out of depression. One of the things that I would like to see a real study tackle is, we've talked about New Mexico's low workforce participation rates. Not having a job, if you're a potentially productive individual, especially a young male, sitting at home by yourself, that kind of behavior is directly correlated with a lot of drug and alcohol abuse problems. Could we do better? Could we do better by our citizens by encouraging and prodding those people to get into the workforce, rather than sitting at home picking up government welfare checks, and what role does that all play in not just alcohol abuse, but of course we have drug abuse problems and all manner of problems in this state. And it really isn't a particularly good look for a group of legislators and a governor that just got done legalizing marijuana to then start going after a different competing, if you will, industry, alcoholic drinks. It really seems like a strange juxtaposition just in a broad scale. So there's a lot of things about that that I think are pretty wonky in terms of why they would be talking about raising taxes now. We're obviously before legislative session, election's still coming up. We're going to be talking a little bit more about that as January comes into clear focus. But right now, it's all about getting out to the polls and voting and seeing who's going to be up there in Santa Fe, including the governor's race.
Okay, and then we've got about 4 minutes. Let's talk a little bit about a recent, I think it was a survey that you found by Allied Van Lines.
Yeah, this is one of those surveys that, you know, Allied Van Lines, they're the ones physically moving the stuff across the country when people want to move. And, you know, you can say, well, that's not a representative sample. True, but it's very good data. And Allied Van Lines had a report that recently came out for 2021. Now, this is still heavy COVID time last year, of course. And they found that the states where people were moving from were most notably California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland, all of them blue states.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought it was because all those states were experiencing COVID.
Well, they were experiencing COVID lockdowns at higher levels than a lot of the other
true.
Places.
This is true.
But also Arizona, Texas, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Florida were the states people were moving to. Okay. Overwhelmingly red states, and Texas, Tennessee, and Florida being zero-income states, which dovetails nicely with the fact that California is a place where people are increasingly moving out of. And this Allied Van Lines study noted that, saying that California had the second highest outbound rate of any state in the country, with two-thirds of moves involving California being outbound. Where are Californians moving to? Seattle, Dallas, Houston, Austin, and Phoenix. Seattle, Dallas, Houston, and Austin all being zero-income tax cities. Maybe blue cities in blue states, but they're all zero income tax. And, you know, Californians are paying up to a 13.3% tax at the state level alone for high earners. So not having an income tax is a big deal for folks in California, or folks leaving California, making that decision. Phoenix has a relatively low income tax. Of course, they're not moving to New Mexico, at least in not particularly high numbers. We do know, we all know, we have Californians in our lives, people who've moved here from California. And whether they vote and how they vote based on California versus their new state is an open question. It's something that I think it would be worth a lot of good research to find out exactly how those people evolve and change as they leave California, whether they do or do not, and how that affects the states they move to. But it is quite interesting to know where those Californians are moving to in some of those big cities with low tax burdens.
Well, Paul, we're looking forward to having you back in again next month. Less than a minute left. And what might you see on the radar that we may be discussing in the near future?
Well, we're going to be facing electoral results and what all that means for the New Mexico legislature, for the country. I'd love to talk in a little more depth about how these midterm elections will affect what happens with the Supreme Court of the United States, depending on Senate control. If the GOP takes both bodies, how they are going to push back on Biden's agenda on a broad scale. I think that's going to be an interesting time. And so, folks, get out there and vote, and we'll see you after the election.
All right, Paul, thanks again so much. We appreciate you coming in. Paul Gessing with the Rio Grande Foundation. Make sure to go to the website, riograndefoundation.org, and join us again on Monday's ABQ Connect.
ABQ Connect is a production of KLYT.
The views expressed on ABQ Connect do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KLYT.